life, but she didn't see a cardboard box. She walked beside the car to the far wall, where there was a red gardening cart with two wheels, with a rake, shovel, and a spade with a long handle. Suddenly, the fluorescent light flickered and phased off, plunging her in darkness. Perfect, Judy said to herself, reaching for her phone, flicking on the flashlight function, and aiming it at the far wall, walking over to look for the box. A cone of intense brightness traveled over a green heavy-duty hose, a bag of Miracle-Gro potting soil, yellow jugs of Preen and white of Roundup, a stinky spray bottle of rabbit and deer repellent, and a red jug of something called Seven with a label that showed creepy pictures of ticks, worms, and God knows what. Gross. Judy pointed the flashlight along the floor to the right and spotted a large purple plastic chest next to the same type of chest in blue, but still didn't see the damn box. She went over to the wall and started rummaging around, jiggling the flashlight to search through a dirty assortment of trowels, hand spades, and a weird tool that looked like it could dislodge an eyeball, but still no box. The flashlight's beam fell on the plastic chests, which were large, and she considered that maybe the cardboard box was inside one of them. She couldn't remember whether her aunt's chest was the purple one or the blue, but no matter. She went over to the blue one, opened the lid, and aimed the flashlight inside. But all it contained was a pair of messy knee pads, a red Phillies cap, a kneeling pad, and a bunch of mismatched gardening gloves in wacky patterns like kittens, puppies, and daisies. The chest was such a happy clutter that it had to belong to her aunt. She closed the lid, and just to be thorough, went over and opened the lid to what had to be Iris's chest. She aimed the flashlight inside, but no cardboard box was there either. Only a pair of oversized white cotton gloves, sitting neatly folded atop a clean trowel and spade, and underneath that was a book entitled Roses for the Beginner, with a greeting card sticking out from the cover, on top of some old newspapers. She reached for the book, opened the cover, and inside was a birthday card. Judy opened it to find her aunt's handwriting. Iris, you are already a better gardener than this guy. Happy birthday. From B. Touched, Judy replaced the card, closed the book, and was about to put it back when she noticed a large white envelope sticking out from underneath the old newspapers. She picked up the envelope, which was heavy and bulky but unsealed. She lifted up the flap, looked inside, and couldn't believe what she was seeing. It must have been the flashlight playing tricks on her eyes. She knelt on the garage floor, set her flashlight on the edge of the chest so that it cast light on the envelope, and slid out its contents. In her hand was a thick stack of cash, bound with a rubber band. Chapter 12. Judy entered her aunt's house with a cardboard box of the rose cutting and an old needlepoint bag she found in the garage, which contained the cash from Iris's gardening chest. The living room was empty, for which she was grateful because she needed a moment to compose herself. She estimated the cash to be about $10,000, though she hadn't taken the time to count it. She set the box, bag, and her purse down, her thoughts racing. She didn't know if the cash belonged to Iris or if her aunt knew about it or why it was in the garage. She reasoned that it probably belonged to Iris because it had been in her gardening chest, and also that her aunt didn't know about it because Aunt Barb wouldn't have kept cash in the garage. Judy remembered what her aunt had said about Iris wanting to keep the garage locked. Evidently, she wasn't worried about somebody stealing the new lawnmower. Judy, her mother asked, coming downstairs in Aunt Barb's pink chenille bathrobe covered with whimsical flowers, what took you so long? Sorry. Judy moved the needlepoint bag behind the couch with her foot. Nobody needed more drama before the mastectomy Monday morning. The light went off in the garage and I couldn't find the box Aunt Barb wanted me to bring in. It was on the other side of the car. No, I mean tonight. What took you so long tonight? You two were out for hours. Her mother reached the bottom of the stairs with a frown. She'd washed off her makeup, but her hair was still up in its top knot, though it was slipping. Your aunt said you went for a drive, but she didn't say where, and she just fell asleep in her clothes, exhausted. You couldn't have gone for an ice cream because nothing around here is open late. Judy decided to tell the truth, because the only lie she told her mother was that she was eating healthy, getting enough sleep, and not working too hard. We made two stops. One to Iris's job to find out if she'd gone in today, which she hadn't, and the other to her apartment to talk to her roommates and get some clothes to bury her in. Her mother's frown took a permanent residence. "Why didn't you call me?" "We texted," Judy said, but even she knew it sounded weak. "You couldn't pick up the phone and talk to me? Why did you leave me hanging?" "Sorry, we should have called. Hold on, let me get something to eat." Judy felt starved all of a sudden, so she walked into the darkened kitchen and flicked on the light. It had been too long a day, capped off with the discovery of the hidden money. It got her thinking that Iris might not be the saint that she'd seemed to be. "Is there any leftover chicken?" "Please don't make a mess in the kitchen." Her mother followed her inside, leaning on the archway, her arms still folded. "It's 11 o'clock. The kitchen's closed for the night." "I'm not going to make a mess." Judy had forgotten her mother had a kitchen closed rule, a necessity with four kids, but less so tonight. Even so, to keep the peace, she bypassed the refrigerator, went into the cabinet, grabbed a glass, and filled it with water. "You didn't answer my question." "What question?" "Why didn't you call me?" "Mom, we should have, and I apologized." Judy sipped the water, but it did nothing to satisfy her hunger, which only made her cranky. "I'll tell you why you didn't call me. You didn't call me because you knew I would tell you not to do it. Your aunt needs to rest and take care of herself. She isn't a well woman, don't you know that?" "Yes, but she wanted to get it done before her operation on Monday." "You shouldn't have listened." "Mom, what was I supposed to do? She's a big girl, and Iris was her best friend." Her mother scoffed. "Iris wasn't her best friend. She was a paid companion. They didn't know each other that well." Judy realized her mother might be right if the secret money meant anything. "Still, Aunt Barb said she was her best friend. She told me in the car at the scene." "That's ridiculous. I would have known if she was her best friend." "She didn't want to tell us because we might not approve." Judy didn't need to add, and she was right. "How can they be best friends? They don't even speak the same language." "They find a way to talk to each other. It's not impossible." Judy couldn't resist adding, "You're the linguist, right? People can learn a new language." "Oh, please. The woman is illiterate." Her mother gave a quick shake of the head. "In any event, I'm very disappointed in you." "What? Why?" Judy moved to put the glass in the dishwasher, but it was already running. She reached for the Palmolive, twisted on the faucet, and began to wash the glass in the sink. "I think you encouraged your aunt going to the scene with her. She has things to do. People like Myra who called here for her. She must have turned off her cell, so they called here. What were you thinking?" Judy recoiled, surprised. "I didn't have any choice. I wasn't going to let her go alone." "Why not? You should have said you wouldn't go, like I did." "Why?" Judy twisted off the faucet, slipped a dish rag off the hook, and dried off the stupid glass. "What purpose would that have served?" "She might not have gone. She could have identified Iris from a picture on the email. Even I could see it was Iris, and I only met the woman once. I said I wouldn't go, but you undermined me, and the two of you went traipsing off." Her mother gestured vaguely to the door. "Mom, please don't blow it out of proportion. I was just trying to be nice to her. She's lost her best friend right before her mastectomy. Does it get any worse? I was just thinking of her." "And I'm not?" Her mother's blue eyes flared, her anger growing. "I didn't say you weren't." Judy felt nonplussed. She didn't want to fight, but she didn't see a way to head it off. "I think we're both trying to help her, you and me, each of us in our own way. Honey, take your cues from me right now. Follow my lead. Your aunt is at sixes and sevens, more upset about the procedure than you know." "Did she say that?" "No, but she doesn't know what she wants right now. We have to call the shots for her." "No, we don't, Mom." "Yes, we do." Her mother folded her arms in the thick bathrobe and Judy's chest tightened. "She's not a child. The chemo makes her thinking foggy. It clouds the brain. I read that in the books. You heard what she said this afternoon. She's not on the chemo now. It's still in her system." Judy suppressed an eye roll. "Why don't we not go there? Neither of us are doctors." "The correct verb is, and you don't have to be a doctor. It's common sense. Open your eyes. You saw her tonight. She's very emotional. She's all over the place. She doesn't know her own mind right now. Mom, she's having a mastectomy, not a lobotomy. She has cancer, not schizophrenia. What is that supposed to mean? It means she's not crazy. She knows her own mind. Tomorrow, she wants to go to church and plant a rosebush for Iris. Am I supposed to go with her or not? Church? Her mother frowned in confusion. When was the last time she went to church? It's not for her. She's going to Iris's church, and she wants to talk to the priest about funeral plans. She's burying her now? Her mother asked, incredulous. Where's she going to get the money? I don't know, Judy answered, thinking of the 10 grand in the needlepoint bag. And I suppose you think you're going with her to this church? I was going to. You should too. Where is it? Who cares, Mom? It's church. What could your possible objection be? Have you been listening to me at all? Veins popped out in her mother's lovely forehead. I don't think she should go, or you either, driving around. She should stay home and rest. Pack a go bag, like it says in the books. We need to make sure she has her front closure shirts, slip-on shoes, ice packs, and alcohol pads for her drains. Also the compression bras. We didn't get to talk about any of that yet. Can't I get those things for her Monday afternoon? She says she has one day of freedom left. If she wants to go to church, she should go to church. Why do you have to talk to me this way? What way? Is this a lawyer thing? You turn everything into an argument. I am not. You are. Judy couldn't help but raise her voice. What are you talking about? Her mother shook her head. You're the one who ran off sending funny texts instead of calling. What is it with you two? Did you have your fun? Fun? Judy felt her own anger give way. Do you think it was fun to go identify Iris tonight? Do you think we were having a good time trying to understand how she died? You know, Mom, I don't understand you. It's like you're jealous. Her mother's lips parted, and she stepped backwards. Jealous of what? You're jealous of me and Aunt Barb. You're even jealous of Iris and Aunt Barb. Judy regretted that the words had slipped out of her mouth, but it was too late to stop now. Why aren't you happy that Aunt Barb had a best friend in Iris? Why aren't you happy that Aunt Barb is close to me? You should be happy for her. She's your sister. How dare you speak to me that way? Her mother's eyes widened in outrage, but Judy could see a flicker of pain cross her forehead and realize that she had just answered her own question. It was because Aunt Barb was her sister that her mother wanted to be the one who was closer to her. But Judy had no way to take the words back or to change their truth. Still, her mother didn't need it thrown in her face, and Judy felt a wave of shame. Mom, I'm sorry, she said, her cheeks aflame. But her mother had already turned away, hurrying from the kitchen. Chapter 13. Sunday morning, Judy and her Aunt Barb found themselves completely out of place in the crowd heading for the parking lot to the church. Judy was the only blonde, and they were taller than everyone by a foot, so they stood out like walking lighthouses. Besides that, everyone seemed to know each other, greeting each other with hugs and kisses, and there were kids of all ages holding hands, jumping up and down, laughing and talking, filling the air with Spanish and English, making a collectively happy bubble of families flowing toward the tall, arched doors of the church. It's such a pretty church, isn't it? Aunt Barb said pleasantly as they approached. It sure is. Judy tucked her aunt's arm under hers, a spontaneous burst of affection. Her aunt had come downstairs this morning determined to go, even though Judy could see that her eyes were puffy, undoubtedly from crying. It had been a tense breakfast, with Judy's mother characteristically reserved toward her, just short of the silent treatment. If Aunt Barb had noticed, she kept it to herself. And her mother had surprised no one by deciding that she wouldn't go to church with them, but instead would pack the go bag. The church is relatively new and looks it, doesn't it? Yes, it does, Judy said, as they reached the sidewalk that led to the doors. The church was a lovely structure, and its tan stucco exterior, arched windows, and rounded bell tower topped with red tiles suggested its Spanish design. Have you ever been to a Catholic church? No. Judy wished Mary were here, her guide to all things Catholic. Will the service be in Spanish? Yes, and this is the one we always went to, her aunt answered as they filed in behind the line. Father Keegan performs it, and your mother would be happy to know he's Irish, complete with freckles. He always jokes that they keep him here as a token. But he's not white, he's pink. Judy smiled but flashed on the $10,000 cash. Her aunt would have mentioned it if she had known about its existence, and Judy didn't want to tell her about it yet, because she didn't want to upset her before her operation. By the way, remember when you were talking about how you used to give Iris clothes and things? Sure, yes. Do you think she ever sold them? No, of course not. Why not? Judy inched up as the line toward the entrance shifted forward. Do you know what her financial situation was like? Not really. I paid her well, and she never complained about money. I knew she could live well enough to take care of herself, and she was careful about her money. How so? Whenever we ran an errand, like to the garden center, she never bought anything for herself. Same thing when we went for chemo. I would treat her in the coffee shop. She never spent money. Judy doubted that Iris could have saved as much money as had been in the garage. Did she have a bank account or anything? No, her aunt answered, lowering her voice as they entered the church. Generally, you need a passport or a social security number for a bank account. I don't think she had either. So she kept it in cash? Judy passed through an anteroom with buttery yellow walls and a warm orange-tiled floor, containing a carved wooden angel and a blue-cloaked Virgin Mary standing next to the American flag. I really don't know. I know it's none of my business, but did you ever give Iris money? Sure, as gifts, when I could get her to take it. Why do you ask? Judy thought fast, lying even as she walked past a marble stand that held a bowl of holy water. I'm thinking about her estate now that she's gone. I'm wondering if I should try to follow up with that. I doubt that there's much money in it, but that's a good idea. Perhaps next week you could try to locate it. Iris's friend, Daniela, might be able to help. Thanks so much for thinking of it. You're welcome, Judy told her, feeling guilty for keeping the discovery of the money from her aunt. A material omission in front of a painted plaster bust of a smiling Pope Francis resting on a windowsill. A bank of candles flickered in red glasses below a primitive wooden crucifix, and a bronze plaque on the wall read, Madre de Dios Church, with the names of benefactors and supporters. They walked through the large tiled lobby, where everyone milled about greeting each other, and nuns with blue aprons over their gray habits threaded their way through the crowd, with rosary beads hanging from their waists. One of the young nuns emerged from the crowd, took Judy's hand and shook it. Welcome, ladies, the nun said in an accented English, her brown eyes friendly. Thank you, Judy said. And the nun greeted her aunt. Then they passed through modern glass doors into one of the loveliest churches Judy had ever seen. The vaulted ceiling was a full 2 stories tall, and the walls were of buttery yellow lined with stained glass windows, but the altar caught her eye. It was white and large, spanning all the way to the ceiling, and its curved shape echoed the exterior of the church itself. A crucifix hung at its apex, and along its right and left sides were painted pictures of men and women farmers, which would have been equally at home in America or Mexico. The church was packed, and Judy and her aunt slid into the last oak pew and sat down, which was when she realized that everybody else knelt and crossed themselves before they went into the pews. She watched fascinated as one family made double and triple crosses over their foreheads and mouths before they took their seats, and she tried not to feel like a total Spanish Catholic rookie. The congregation settled down as Father Keegan swept to the altar, took the oak lectern and opened his palms, then began speaking in rapid Spanish. He was dressed in white robes with a green overlay and looked to be middle-aged, with wire-rimmed glasses, graying hair, and a ready smile. Judy got the gist of what he was saying, which was to thank everybody for coming, tell them that God loves them, and that they should have faith in him. Suddenly, Father Keegan's expression saddened. He continued speaking, but had spotted Aunt Barb and Judy, making eye contact with them. Father Keegan said the name Iris Juarez, and Judy's aunt nodded, her eyes filming as she whispered to Judy, "He's telling everybody that Iris died yesterday of a heart attack. He's asking everyone to pray for her soul." "Oh my," Judy said under her breath, as murmuring, sniffling, and tears rippled through the congregation. She put her arm around her aunt, who bent her head as Father Keegan began to lead the congregation in prayer, evidently for Iris. The church echoed with the sibilant softness of the Spanish language, and Aunt Barb began to cry, resting her head on Judy's shoulder. Judy listened to Father Keegan conduct the Mass, then watched everyone line up to receive Holy Communion. But all the time she was wondering about the $10,000 in the garage. The Mass ended shortly thereafter, and the congregation rose to leave. And by the time she and her aunt stood up, Judy was already getting an idea. "Aunt Barb, why don't we go see Father Keegan? I think it would be nice to thank him for remembering Iris in the service." "I was thinking the same thing, honey." Her aunt smiled at her, and Judy felt another guilty pang for lying. They walked up the center aisle as the congregation filed past them, the parents falling into conversation and the children skipping ahead in groups. They reached the front of the church and waited their turn to speak with Father Keegan, who was standing beside the lectern talking with an older woman. When his conversation was over, the priest motioned them forward, broke into a sad smile, and extended a hand to Aunt Barb. "Barb, I'm so sorry about Iris," Father Keegan said, shaking her hand. "What a terrible shock for all of us. You saw for yourself the reaction of the congregation. The community is praying for her soul. You have my deepest sympathies." "Thank you so much, Father Keegan." Aunt Barb's lips trembled, suppressing her emotion. "I thought the world of her, you know that. And you know she loved you and this church. She talked about you and how much you've done for the community." "This is my niece, Judy Carrier." Judy shook the priest's hand. "Pleased to meet you." "And you too," Father Keegan smiled. And up close, his eyes were a lively blue, and his skin actually was freckled. Father Keegan turned to her aunt. "Iris was one of our most devoted parishioners, and I was so shocked to hear what happened. It's a loss for all of us." "It certainly is. I will be responsible for seeing that she receives a proper burial." "That's very kind of you. Let me know when you receive her remains from the coroner, and we will have a Mass for her."
"Thank you."
Judy interjected. "Father Keegan, may I ask you, how did you find out about her passing?"
"I got a telephone call last night from Detective Boone. He's in charge of the matter."
Judy took the lead.
"He is, and we had a question or two about her death, like why she didn't go to work that day. We asked at Mike's Exotics, and they said she just didn't show up. Can you shed any light on that?"
Father Keegan shook his head.
"No, and that's what I told the detective. It did seem unusual to me. It wouldn't be like Iris."
Judy continued.
"We're not sure why she was on Brandywine Way in the first place. Do you have any idea about that?"
"I can't help you there either," Father Keegan shook his head.
"Could she have been visiting someone, a friend perhaps? Daniela? We spoke with her roommates, but they don't know."
"Not that I know of. Iris had Daniela, but not many close friends." Father Keegan's gaze shifted to Judy's aunt.
"Mrs. Meyer, I think you are her closest friend."
Aunt Barb swallowed visibly. Judy glossed over the painful moment, taking over the conversation.
"Do you have the names and addresses of any of her cousins in Mexico? We were wondering about what to do with any monies remaining in her estate."
Father Keegan cocked his head. "I don't know any of them, unfortunately. I doubt that she had much money, a will, or anything of that sort."
"Father Keegan, was Daniela here today?" No, she wasn't. But she isn't as devoted as Iris. Do you know where we can find her? We don't even know if she knows that Iris has passed. I'm sure she does. Word travels fast in this community. Daniela would be at the mission. She works there, too. Is that nearby? Judy asked, thinking ahead. Chapter 14. Damn, we should have gotten the address. Judy drove back and forth on the same two-lane road trying to find the mission, but they kept getting lost. Then I could have plugged it into the GPS. Father Keegan said it was next to the firehouse, Aunt Barb said, her face to the window. There's the firehouse straight ahead, and the only thing next to it is that strip mall. Judy stopped at a traffic light, eyeing the rundown strip mall of three crappy storefronts, one of which had a handmade going-out-of-business sign. Can you have a mission in a storefront? Pull in. Let's see, Aunt Barb clucked. You know, I've been down this road a bunch of times, but I've never seen a mission. It's as if all of this existed around me, but I never noticed it before. I know what you mean. Judy was thinking about how much her Aunt Barb hadn't noticed about Iris. The hidden cache made her feel uneasy, and it seemed to mirror what her aunt was saying about the neighborhood. There were things in plain sight that they should have seen, but they'd missed. The light's green, her aunt said, pulling Judy out of her reverie. She cruised forward, crossed the intersection, and turned into the crappy strip mall, which held a tiny parking lot in front of the stores. She spotted a battered Hyundai leaving the strip mall from the back. Maybe it's behind the stores? Again, no sign. Evidently, everybody who needs it knows where it is. Right. Judy steered around the back, entered a littered back lot, and hit the brakes quickly, surprised to find small children running around, playing on old upholstered couches, used card tables, scattered mattresses. Yikes. Good thing I was going slow. I'll say. I guess this is it. Judy eyed a rusty white dumpster that read, Society of St. Vincent de Paul. The back of the building was a dingy gray stucco, cluttered with electric meters and heating units, next to an unmarked glass door, which stood open, propped up by a cinder block. Hey, that's my ottoman, Aunt Barb exclaimed, opening the door. What do you mean? Judy cut the ignition, took her purse, and got out of the car. That flowery ottoman next to the maroon couch? Aunt Barb pointed, climbing out of the passenger seat. I don't remember that ottoman. You wouldn't. It's from the old house. And I kept it in the garage because it didn't go with the new furniture. I always thought I'd get it reupholstered, but I never got around to it. I gave it to Iris when we cleaned out the garage. She said it was pretty, and I thought she could use it. When did you clean out the garage? Judy's ears pricked up, wondering when Iris had put the money in her storage chest. About a week ago, I was feeling better and I wanted to clear the decks before my mastectomy. Was it your idea to clean the garage? Yes, and I totally forgot about the ottoman when we went to Iris's apartment. She didn't have the room for it, so she must have brought it here. Aunt Barb shook her head when they reached the ottoman. An ottoman is a rich people thing, when you think about it. It requires room, space. I'm not rich by any means, but I have room for an ottoman. I assumed she did, too. Aunt Barb sighed. I don't know what I was thinking. I've been so insensitive living in my own little world. That's not true. You didn't know. Maybe I didn't want to know. Or maybe I should have known. Isn't that the height of insensitivity, that you just didn't know because you couldn't imagine that people lived a different life from the one you do? Aunt Barb kept shaking her head. Isn't that the very definition of insensitivity, of selfishness? Not at all. You are being generous, and you can't find a negative in that. Judy guided her aunt toward the open door. Aunt Barb, when I was in the garage last night, I noticed that there were two plastic chests, the same type but different colors. Was one of those Iris's? Yes, I gave it to her, the purple one, for Iris, get it? Judy had missed that. What's it for? I got her my favorite gardening tools, a trowel, a spade, and the best fork for weeding. There's only one that works really well. Her aunt's face fell. Poor Iris. I don't think I could bring myself to see that chest now. You ever go in the chest? No, why would I? I have my own tools. Judy felt reassured. Do you want me to take it away? No, not at all. I want it to stay just the way it is. I still have your uncle's jackets in the closet. That's okay, whatever you want. Judy squeezed her arm, and they entered the building, their eyes adjusting to the cramped, dimly lighted room. Women speaking Spanish looked over briefly, then returned to going through cardboard boxes of used toys, books, and children's shoes. Kids played underneath metal rolling racks stuffed with clothes, and Judy recognized one of the little girls from church. Judy, look over there. Aunt Barb gestured at one of the racks. I see two of the dresses I gave her hanging up, and some of the shoes, too. So this must be where she brought it. She gave it to the mission, like Maria Elena said. How nice is she? I mean, was. Judy saw grief cross her aunt's face. She was nice, but I wonder why she didn't tell you. I bet she thought it would hurt my feelings. That's probably why, Judy said, wondering what other reasons Iris could have had for keeping secrets, as well as how she got the money and why she stowed it in her aunt's garage. There's the counter. Aunt Barb led the way toward an ancient cash register on a plywood counter. Behind it, shoes, rain boots, and work boots sat stacked on old wooden shelves, next to a random array that included an old bicycle, floor lamps without shades, and a push lawnmower that was missing a blade. They lingered at the counter. Then one of the women came over from the far side of the room with a smile. She was in her 30s, but heavily pregnant, and her belly strained both her sweatshirt and jeans. "Hello, ladies," she said in English with only the hint of an accent. "Is there something I can do for you?" "Yes," Aunt Barb answered. "My name is Barb Moyer, and this is my niece Judy. We were friends of Iris Juarez's." "Oh, no." The woman's face creased with sadness, and she extended a small hand. "I'm Maria. I'm so sorry about Iris. We all loved her." "Thank you, and I'm sorry for your loss." Aunt Barb released her hand. "We're looking for Daniela. Father Keegan sent us." Maria blinked. "Daniela isn't here." "Oh, I got the impression she worked here on Sundays." "She does, usually, sometimes with Iris." "But Daniela didn't come in today?"
"No. They called me this morning to come in for her, so I came in. Sunday is a busy day for us after Mass. We have to open."
"Why didn't she come in? Is she sick?"
"No."
"Do you know where Daniela is, where she lives? We'd like to go talk with her."
Maria hesitated, and Judy became aware that the women had stopped talking in the background, evidently eavesdropping as they looked through the clothes and shoes.
"She went home."
"Where? Kennett Square?"
"No, home, to Mexico."
"Really?"
Aunt Barb frowned, puzzled. Judy hid her surprise that Daniela would leave the country on the same weekend her friend turned up dead. "When did she leave?"
"I don't know."
"When was the last time she worked here?"
"Friday, I think."
Maria scratched her cheek, her manner suddenly hesitant. Aunt Barb rested a hand on the counter, seemingly tired again, so Judy took over.
"Maria, who told you to come in today? Who called you?"
"Lupe."
"Who's she?"
"She's like the boss."
"What did she say?"
Maria pursed her lips. "She said I had to come to work because Daniela went home."
"Did she say when Daniela went home?"
"No."
"Did she say why?"
"No."
"How did she know?"
"I don't know. I don't know anything more than she told me."
Maria averted her dark eyes.
"What's Lupe's phone number?"
"I don't know."
"What's Lupe's last name?"
"Why?"
Maria edged backwards, resting a hand on her pregnant belly.
"Maria, we're just friends of Iris's, and there's no hidden agenda here. It would really help us if we could talk to Lupe. If she called you on your cell phone, you could just look at the phone to get her number."
Maria shook her head.
I don't feel good telling you her number.
I understand. Judy didn't want to give up.
Maria, how about you tell us Lupe's last name then?
We're just trying to talk to her about Iris's death. They were friends, and somebody should tell Daniela that Iris died, don't you think?
I don't know.
Please.
Judy smiled in a way that she hoped looked reassuring. Suddenly her phone began ringing in her back pocket.
We'll keep the information to ourselves, I promise. How about you tell me her last name and I'll get the number myself?
No, no, no. Maria backed away from the counter. I don't feel comfortable.
But we could get that information anywhere.
Father Keegan would tell us her last name. You would just be saving us the trouble of asking him.
Then ask him, please, ask him.
Really? Judy's phone kept ringing, and Aunt Barb took her arm, looking at her with pained eyes.
Judy, let's go. I don't want to upset anybody. That's not the point.
You want to leave?
Yes, please.
Aunt Barb gestured at the ringing phone. And you should answer that. I bet it's your mom. And we don't need to make her angrier than she already is.
She can wait.
It could be an emergency.
All right, I hear you.
Judy checked her phone on the fly. As it turned out, it wasn't her mother, but it was an emergency of sorts. Chapter 15. Judy hustled to the counter of the modern octagonal desk that dominated the busy emergency room, which was staffed with medical personnel hustling this way and that. She had been sent back into the ER by the department's receptionist, who hadn't known which examining room Frank was in. Evidently, he'd re-injured his wrist in his basketball game, and Judy was hoping that it wasn't broken, because she wanted to break it herself.
Excuse me, I'm looking for Frank Lucia?
Judy addressed the medical personnel in general, because she didn't know which one to talk to. The doctor was on the phone, but both nurses looked up at her, one from the computer keyboard and the other from the printer.
And you are?
Asked the nurse at the printer, standing with an open palm as a document eked out of the tray. She was pretty, with cropped red hair and green eyes so bright they could have been contacts. Fabric daisies curled around the rubbery black stem of her stethoscope, and her scrubs were Barbie pink.
I'm Judy Carrier, his girlfriend.
Judy caught a quick exchange of glances between the two nurses, sensing their collective disappointment that Frank had a girlfriend, a familiar reaction.
Great,
the nurse flashed a smile that tried but failed. He's in room 7. I'm Melanie, his nurse, and he's ready to be discharged if you can drive him. He can't drive himself because of the Percocet.
Was he in pain?
Judy tried not to sound hopeful.
Initially, he had some discomfort.
Poor thing, Judy said, but she really meant good. She was hoping he was very uncomfortable.
What was the injury exactly? He wasn't very specific on the phone. Did he re-injure it?
Yes, there was no new fracture, but the doctor had to reset the bone so it would heal properly. We gave him another cast. Judy wanted to give him a new cast right in the face.
So, playing basketball caused the bone to shift.
Yes, and the soft tissue in his wrist swelled during the night. He narrowly avoided another surgery.
So, does that mean the healing process has to start over from the beginning? Are we talking 8 to 12 weeks?
Yes, and I explained to him that he has to be patient. He can engage in only limited activity. I know that won't be easy for him, seeing as how he makes his living with his hands.
Judy couldn't suppress her eye roll.
Or maybe people who make a living with their hands shouldn't play so much basketball.
Do you think concert pianists shoot a lot of hoops?
Ha! The nurse laughed lightly. Everybody needs to have fun.
Do they? I'm a lawyer. I don't believe in fun.
All work and no play makes Jack a dull boy.
I wouldn't know, Judy shot back, then realized it sounded harsher than she felt. Or maybe it was exactly how she felt, and she didn't know how harshly she felt until this very moment. But the nurses were exchanging significant glances again.
I'll be right in with his prescription and discharge papers.
Thanks. Judy turned away, her chest tight. She walked down the gleaming hall until she found the right examining room, pushed aside the privacy curtain, and went in.
"Babe," Frank grinned in a loopy way, lying fully clothed on the bed, his eyes at a druggy half-mast. His left arm was back in its familiar blue cotton sling, and a fresh blue nylon cast covered his wrist to the knuckles. His skin was uncharacteristically pale, his hair disheveled, and his gray logo fleece and jeans looked rumpled enough to have come from the hamper, which they probably did. Judy felt herself softening and went to him.
"How are you feeling?"
"I feel great. I feel awesome. I love you."
Frank hugged her close, then threw up his arms like he'd scored a touchdown or maybe a three-pointer.
"Life is good."
"Good." Judy gave him a grudging kiss on his grisly cheek. His breath smelled like onions, but luckily she loved onions.
"Thanks for coming to get me."
"No problem. Thanks for playing basketball." Judy couldn't help her sarcasm. She'd had to race back to Aunt Barb's house and drop her off, leaving her aunt to face Iris's death, Daniela's disappearance, and her impending mastectomy, with only Judy's mom for company. The entire weekend had been cut short because Judy wouldn't have time to go back to Kennett Square tonight and still be at work tomorrow morning.
"Uh-oh. Are you pissed off at me?"
Frank pouted comically, his reaction exaggerated by pharmaceuticals.
"Let's go home, Frank."
Judy retrieved his puffy black jacket from the chair.
"Sit up, please, and I'll help you on with your coat." "Don't be mad. I didn't do it on purpose."
Frank sat up groggily, and Judy held his shoulder to support him.
"Of course you didn't. Nobody hurts himself on purpose."
"Right, then why are you pissed?"
Judy picked up his right hand and began stuffing it in the sleeve of his coat. "You decided to play basketball with an already injured hand, so it was completely foreseeable that you'd hurt yourself."
"Wow, you sounded like such a lawyer just then."
Frank broke into a grin.
"It's because you said foreseeable. Lawyers say that. Also, Judge Judy."
Judy draped the coat over his bad arm, thinking that it didn't seem right that Frank kept doing dumb things and sticking her with a mess. Maybe that's what was bothering her, the very injustice of their relationship. She turned when she heard a noise behind her, and the nurse entered the room carrying a few sheets of paper.
"Here are your discharge papers, Frank."
"Hi, Melissa."
Frank stood up, then listed to the left.
"Whoa, my stomach feels funny."
"That's the perks," the nurse smiled at him, her eyes soft with sympathy. "Can you sign these for me?"
"Aw, sure, Melissa. Then again, maybe not."
Frank sank down into the bed, and Judy took the pen and papers from the nurse's hand.
"I'll sign. Drunky McDrunkerson is losing his sea legs."
Judy scribbled Frank's name, handed back the pen and papers, and managed to get them both out of the ER and through the hospital exit doors onto a busy 7th Street, where she took Frank's arm.
"You feel well enough to walk? I'm parked in the garage."
"Totally,"
Frank answered, though he leaned heavily on her arm as they waited for traffic to let up, then crossed the street. The morning sun had vanished, and gray clouds gathered in the sky. The city air smelled gritty and damp after the freshness of the countryside.
"So you drove here?"
"Yeah, my truck's in the garage. So I'll have to come back for it tomorrow morning. I need it for work. I have to go out to Jersey to bid a job tomorrow."
"Great,"
Judy thought to herself as they went through the door to the garage, found the grimy elevator, climbed alone into a cab with filthy corrugated walls, and watched the broken floor numbers light up. She was in no mood to talk, and Frank had fallen uncharacteristically silent. They got out of the elevator, and when they reached her car, Judy chirped it open and stowed Frank in the passenger seat, where he listed to the left with a grateful smile.
"Thanks, babe. You take such good care of me."
"No worries.
Put on your seatbelt." Judy closed the door, then went around the car, tossed her bag in the back and climbed into the driver's seat, then closed the door behind her.
"You're mad at me. I know. I really am sorry."
"Forget it," Judy said without meaning it. This wasn't the time or the place to talk about anything that mattered, and she had to sort out her thoughts. She put on her seatbelt, started the engine, and reversed out of the spot. The garage was dark and cramped, even by Philly standards, and she steered toward the exit ramp, where they corkscrewed their way downward in darkness.
"Babe, you want to say I told you so, so you should just go ahead and say it."
"I don't want to say I told you so." Judy navigated with care, if only to avoid his eye.
"Yeah, you do. Say it."
"I wish I could get you to understand this, but I don't want to be right. I just want you to do the right thing."
"But it was an accident."
"It was an accident when you injured it the first time." Judy twisted the steering wheel, hugging the concrete center of the down ramp like a descent into urban hell. "It's not an accident when you injure it the second time, because you're not supposed to be playing basketball."
"What am I supposed to do? They didn't have enough guys for a team. They couldn't have entered the tournament."
"You know why they didn't have enough guys?" Judy finally reached the first floor, where she followed exit signs to the cashier. "Because most of the guys are doing what grown-ups do on a Saturday, not playing basketball."
"What are you talking about? You can still be a grown-up and play basketball."
Frank's tone sounded hurt, but Judy didn't look over. The cashier's booth was coming up, and her purse was in the back seat. She'd forgotten to take her wallet out for the parking money.
"Do you have any cash on you?" Judy asked, though she knew the answer. "I only need about 10 bucks.
"No."
"How about a card?"
Judy slid the parking ticket from the visor, knowing the answer too.
"I maxed it out on supplies, so I shouldn't use it."
"Of course you did," Judy thought, but didn't say, simmering. She braked in the line at the booth, twisted around and grappled in the back seat for her purse.
"Anyway, grown-ups play basketball. What do you think the NBA is?"
"That's not the point." Judy yanked open her purse, retrieved her wallet, and found her credit card.
"You need to take care of yourself better. You need to think of yourself."
"That's selfish."
"No, it isn't."
"Yes, it is. They needed me. I needed you too, Frank,"
Judy said, her voice catching. She slid out her Visa card and gave the car some gas. She still couldn't meet his eye.
"What did you need me for? Why?"
"Lots of reasons."
Judy hesitated to tell him, not wanting to make him feel guilty, which was ridiculous. He was in the wrong, so he should feel guilty about it. But she had trained him to think she didn't need him. She steered to the booth, where she handed her credit card and ticket to an older man behind the thick, smudged glass.
"Here we go, sir."
"Like what, babe? What did you need me for?"
"I was in Kennett because Aunt Barb has breast cancer. She's having a mastectomy tomorrow morning. My mom's already there with her."
"Oh, no. I'm sorry."
Frank sounded genuinely shocked, and Judy felt her chest tighten.
"I know, and it's terrible for her. Is she gonna be okay?"
"I hope so."
"I'm sure she will.
It's stage 2, Frank. Not everybody gets better."
"She will."
Frank patted her hand on the stick shift, and Judy glanced over. His eyes looked pained, if unfocused, but he seemed suddenly pale under his grizzly stubble.
"You okay?"
"I don't feel so good. My stomach..."
Judy wanted to explain about the chemo and Iris's death, but he was too sick to listen.
"So, just rest. We'll be home soon."
"Okay, I think I need to."
Frank leaned back against the headrest and closed his eyes.
"I'm sorry about Barb, but she's a strong woman like you. She'll be okay. I know it. Don't worry."
"I'm sure she will be,"
Judy said, but she didn't believe her own words. She took her credit card back from the cashier, steered out of the lot, and motored onto 7th, where she stopped at the traffic light. It had just turned green when her phone rang in her pocket, and she pulled it out quickly. The screen showed a photo of a grinning Mary, and Judy hit a button to talk, but kept her voice low.
"Hi, Mayor, I'm driving."
"Okay, I won't keep you. Did you decide about the cases?"
"What cases?"
Judy felt suddenly teary at the sound of Mary's voice.
"The damages trials."
"I haven't had a chance, sorry. Can we talk about it tomorrow?"
Fine, but what's the matter? You don't sound good.
It's not me. It's my Aunt Barb. She has cancer.
No, not Aunt Barb.
I know. She's having a mastectomy tomorrow.
Judy still found it hard to say.
We're trying to be optimistic. She's optimistic. Oh, God. I'll say a prayer and so will my mom.
Thanks, Judy said. But she didn't know if prayer helped. She wished she had Mary's faith. She wished she had anybody's faith. She could use a credible God right about now.
What can I do?
Nothing, thanks. Where are you now? Back in the city, heading home? I'm at the office. I can be there in 5 minutes. We can hang.
No, I'm fine, thanks.
So is that why your mom came in?
Yes, I was in Kennett Square until today.
Oh, no, poor Barb, she's so nice. You sure you don't need help?
No, I'm fine.
Take the time off if you need to. This week, I'll cover your desk. You're not in court or anything, are you?
I'll be in tomorrow. I have a deposition in the morning.
Judy, don't. Cancel it. Take the day off. Go be with Barb and your mom.
I wanted to, but they told me to go to work.
I'll see them on Monday afternoon after the dep.
Judy glanced at Frank, who had fallen asleep, his head bobbing as they drove over the cobblestones in the historic section of the city. She braked slightly, slowing the car so he wouldn't wake up.
I should go. I just picked up Frank at the ER. He re-injured his hand playing basketball.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. Apparently he's in the NBA.
Mary snorted. I guess he can't wash the dog now.
Bingo! It's all part of the plan, no doubt.
Judy had completely forgotten about the dog, who probably needed to be walked, too.
So I'll be doing flea laundry all night, and I think I'm out of whisk.
Whatever. I gotta go, okay?
Okay, sure. Bye.
Bye.
Judy hung up, pressing the screen to end the call, then steered the rest of the way home, trying to sort out her emotions. She hated to think of the chores that lay ahead tonight. Washing the dog, vacuuming the rugs, and doing the laundry. She had no idea how she'd get the time to go back for Frank's truck. Even so, she knew that worrying about mundane tasks was easier than worrying about her Aunt Barb, Iris, or her mother. But by the time she reached their street, her heart was nonetheless heavy. She reached their neighborhood in artsy old city, its narrow streets lined with art and photo galleries, cool boutiques, and brick row homes of a colonial vintage, which had been converted to apartments. She turned onto her street and took the first parking space that she saw, a few doors from their apartment. She cut the ignition and was about to wake Frank up when she looked over at the building. Standing on her front step was a smiling Mary D'Annunzio, and in her hand was a red plastic jug of whisk. Chapter 16. Here's my question, Judy began to say as she stuffed a sheet into the washing machine. Frank had gone upstairs to bed, and she was standing with Mary in the hallway that passed for a laundry room because the washer-dryer could be covered by a louvered door. Why can't my boyfriend be as awesome as my girlfriend?
It's the boy part, Mary smiled, looking adorable in a pen sweatshirt, jeans, and ponytail.
She had on tortoiseshell glasses she wore when she wasn't at work, but she was even cuter in glasses than contacts, every inch the girl most likely.
No, I mean it.
Judy slammed the washer door closed for emphasis. You're so awesome to show up on my doorstep just when I'm feeling the worst ever.
I can't thank you enough for that.
Honey, you don't have to thank me.
No, you're amazing. You don't even have to be asked. You just know what I need.
Judy cranked the big dial on top of the washing machine to heavy load, because even a single sheet overwhelmed the tiny washer and dryer. Or maybe she was feeling sorry for herself, and suddenly everything seemed like a heavy load.
You sounded bummed on the phone, and we need to catch up. I've been so crazy lately with the wedding and all, and it's nothing to come over. I'm only uptown.
No, it's everything. You're coming over here. It's why you're the best friend ever in the history of friends.
You know what I need even before I do.
Mary chuckled.
All right, already. So what's your point about Frank? You have to cut him a break. He's not at his best right now.
Oh, please, he's not on Percocet all the time, and he wouldn't be on Percocet this time if he made better decisions. Judy uncapped the new whisk jug and poured a blue stream into the little opening in the machine. Aren't you going to measure the detergent? No, I live dangerously. I always measure. I know, and that's why I have a sucky boyfriend and you have a great boyfriend. Sorry, I mean fiancé. Judy set the heavy whisk jug on the washer with a thump. Jeez, this thing is a lethal instrument. You were saying? Mary cued her as usual, and Judy wondered where she'd be without her best friend to keep her on conversational track. I was saying, you don't have to be responsible about everything. Maybe I'm putting in too much detergent, but so what? That you can take a chance with. But playing basketball with a broken hand isn't the kind of thing that smart people take chances with, agree? Yes. So what's his deal? Is he stupid? Judy waited to hear the washing cycle start, and when it did, she shut the louver door. Now let's go find the dog she hides when it's bath time. Of course he's not stupid. He runs his own company. Exactly, so why can't he figure this out? Penny? Penny! Judy padded into the living room in her stocking feet. It's not rocket science. Mary followed her with a confused frown. What can't he figure out again? That I need help. Judy glanced around, but her dog was nowhere in sight. Their small living room looked sweet. Two floor-to-ceiling windows facing south. A funky purple velvet sectional with a flea market Victorian coffee table, and all four walls covered with her bright, abstract oil paintings, except that Frank had left his sweat socks and running sneakers on the ottoman, an open bag of hard pretzels, and a Coors can on the end table without a coaster, and the remote control on the floor beside the couch. See? Look around. Would you leave the place like this? He was going to the ER. He was in pain. He lifted his beer, didn't he? I always have to get after him to clean up. And where's the dog? Penny! Penny, come! Is she upstairs? No. I bet the coat closet. Meanwhile, he was supposed to take the dog to be dipped, but he forgot. So now I have to wash her for myself again, because I just did all the sheets. Judy headed for the entrance hall. Anyway, if he can't figure it out himself, why can't he just watch you? Why can't he just do what you do? Why can't he just copy you, or copy me? If he did for me what I do for him, we'd get along great. He's a fun-loving, happy guy. He's the kind of guy that takes you out to dinner on the spur of the moment. So does that mean he's not an adult? Can't you be a fun-loving adult? We are. Judy opened the door to the coat closet, flicked on the light, and found Penny trembling under the coats, a chubby golden retriever trying to make herself invisible. Penny, come out. I mean, honestly, he's a sucky boyfriend. He's not sucky. You love him, don't you? Yes, but the problem is that he's sucky. Sometimes. Penny, please come out. Judy went inside the closet, grabbed the dog by the collar, and slid her out on the floor. The dog's toenails scraped the hard wood, and her eyes went as round as brown marbles. So Judy stroked her back. It's okay, honey. You need a bath. You don't want fleas, do you? He's not sucky all the time. No, but is that the standard? Penny, come on, sweetie. Let's go. Judy coaxed the dog to the stairwell, where she balked, but the only bathtub was upstairs. Mary, believe me when I tell you, a guy who's sucky sometimes might as well be sucky all the time. Why? That doesn't follow. Yes, it does. Think about it. Judy tried to budge the dog, but Penny crouched on all fours, her hackles shaking and her fluffy head hanging. Bottom line, I can't rely on him. I have to take care of him, and when I need anything, he's not there because he's not used to me asking. You didn't train him. Exactly what I've been thinking, Judy tugged at the dog. Anthony would never pull this crap. He's responsible. I can't take credit. His mother trained him. He never poops on the rug anymore. Judy gave up on moving Penny. I'm going to have to carry her upstairs. I hate that. She weighs a ton. I'll take the front and you take the butt. You don't mind? You've already qualified for sainthood. No, I haven't.
A saint would take the butt.
Thanks. Judy picked up the dog's hind, and Mary came around to the head and shoulders.
Hi, Penny. So you're upset?
Me or the dog? Judy started climbing with Mary behind her, so that Penny traveled backwards up the stairs.
Maybe this isn't the best plan. It's literally ass backwards. Welcome to my world.
You seem so bummed, honey. Are you saying you want to break up with him?
I don't know, but we can't talk about it anymore anyway. Judy worried that Frank might hear them as they got closer to the second floor, so she flared her eyes meaningfully at Mary, who understood instantly, since all women understood meaningful eye flarings.
So talk to me about Aunt Barb. You're worried about her.
I am, but it's not only that. Judy struggled to not drop the soft, heavy dog as she squirmed.
So much happened this weekend, I don't know where to start. Her best friend died,
and it seems really hinky. Plus, I found 10 grand in cash money hidden in her garage.
What?
Mary asked, incredulous, and Judy told her the whole story, from meeting Iris, to hearing about her death from the police, to visiting the scene on Brandywine Road, then Mike's exotics, Iris's apartment, and finally the church and the mission, with Daniela's disappearance. There was so much to tell that the story lasted the entire time they washed, toweled off, and blow-dried the shaking dog, then put in a new load of laundry and finally left to go pick up Frank's truck. They took Judy's car, with Penny asleep in the back seat, in some form of doggy shock.
You know what I think? Judy asked as she steered through the dark city streets to the hospital garage.
It was drizzling and droplets dotted her windshield, but there was no traffic. Sunday nights in Philadelphia, everyone was home, depressed about work the next day.
I think something fishy is going on, considering everything as a whole.
What do you mean?
We have Iris found dead out of nowhere, and her best friend leaves to go back to Mexico, and there's secret money stashed in my aunt's garage. Considering the totality of the circumstances, as the lawyers say, it raises a lot of questions.
Like what?
Like, where did she get the money? Why did she hide it from my aunt? Why did her best friend leave even before her funeral? Who was that call from that she got? And is any of it connected to the hidden money?
Judy felt good to be talking things over with Mary the way she always did. It wasn't about men all the time, just most of the time.
I don't think she was murdered. There were no signs of violence. I saw the body, I know.
Judy shuddered at the memory.
If there had been signs of a violent death or a weapon, I would say the broken nails were a defensive wound.
But there wasn't.
I know, right? I can't wait to see what the coroner turns up. But what if she was murdered and the money had something to do with it?
Judy steered into the darkness, switching on the windshield wipers.
We've handled murder cases before, and if this happened in Philly, we'd put two and two together. Secret money, a sudden disappearance, and a mysterious death.
What more does it take?
It's not a mysterious death. Don't get carried away. But we love to get carried away. And there are legit questions.
Mary snorted.
So what are you thinking? Who would kill Iris and why?
I'm not sure. A few things are possible. I liked Iris.
And stop! Assume you don't know Iris, because you don't.
I do, kind of. Judy flashed on Iris's shy smile in the rose garden. I've been hearing about her for a while. Plus, my Aunt Barb adores her, and she's an excellent judge of character.
Would she if she knew that Iris was keeping some mighty big secrets from her, hiding money in her house?
A good point. Judy stopped at the streetlight, its redness fragmented by the raindrops on the windshield. So we'll put out of our minds that we think Iris is a nice person.
Exactly. And if so, the most likely possibility is that she either stole the money or is mixed up with something unlawful that generated cash.
Why do you say it's from something unlawful?
Because you said she was in the country 3 years and she probably made minimum wage at her job, if that. You can't save that much money that quickly, so she had to come by it another way.
Judy thought about it.
And she would have hidden it because she had no other place to put it. She can't get a bank account
because she doesn't have a social security number, and she can't leave it at her apartment because of the risk of theft. Her roommate told us there's a lot of theft in the undocumented community. So did the cops. Well, of course, because nobody can use a bank. My mother was the same way when she came over from Italy. She always felt like an outsider. She didn't trust the banks. She wouldn't even use a credit card. She kept the money under the mattress. People really do that. Italians do big time. Also, our sleep number is 10 grand. Judy smiled. She still hides money in her coffee cans and her sewing kits, plus $5 in her bra. Judy laughed. But your mom came in legally. There's no analogy. Doesn't matter. It's an immigrant mentality. And these are the new immigrants. And if they're illegal, they're essentially fugitives. They don't trust anybody or anything. They can't call the police. They live in a lawless world. That's why they come and go without a word, like the guy at Mike's told you. They don't play by the same rules. What's your point? So it's not that strange that Daniela would leave, or Iris would hide money, or she couldn't confide in your aunt. She doesn't trust anybody. She can't.
So the question is, what was she up to?
My aunt didn't give her that much, and I don't think she works for anyone else except Mike's.